Welcome to Musings from Sam Houston's Stomping Grounds, a production of the Newton Gresham Library at Sam Houston State University in Huntsville, Texas.
This is Lynn McMain. I'm Head of Reference and Instructional Services at the Newton Gresham Library, and today we have the privilege of speaking with Dr. Tom Chasteen, Professor of Chemistry at Sam Houston State University. Dr. Chasteen has been at Sam Houston State University since 1991, and he became a full professor in 2002. He has an amazing 45 published articles, several books and chapters in books, and numerous presentations, and holds two patents. Dr. Chasteen, Tom, welcome to the library, and thank you for taking the time
to speak with us today. Thank you very much, Lynn, for giving me your time.
It's my pleasure. Tom, I know you obtained your Bachelor of Science in Chemistry from East Texas State University in Commerce, Texas, and that your father was a faculty member there. Would you tell us a little bit about your educational experience?
Yes, I'm glad we're still referring to it as East Texas State University. It's turned into something else. I'm not sure about what the new name is. My father did a PhD in history at University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, and he finished that PhD the year I was born, and then moved to where he could get a job teaching history. He came to East Texas. He came to Texas and Commerce in the late 50s and taught there through the mid-1980s, as a matter of fact. So I guess that's almost 25 years or something like that. So a PhD in history, and my mother, a PhD in English, are the kind of the academic background that suggested to me that people would want to be a teacher for a living, a college teacher for a living. And they are the models and the reason why I went on. I remember my mother saying to me, as I started to work and move farther and farther into the sciences, she said, whose area was English, said, if this becomes too difficult, you can always go to another field. She was never sure whether I could do it after finishing a BS in chemistry at East Texas State and then a master's, their first graduate degree at East Texas State. She said, "You want to do more? You know, why do you want to do more?" In her field, master's was pretty much as far as many people went, even though she had a PhD, a terminal degree in her field. So, I come from a long line. In theory, her mother was a math teacher at a one-room a schoolhouse in Illinois in the 1920s and 30s. Her father, my grandfather, was a chemist at a high school in Greensboro, North Carolina, in the 40s and probably the 30s and the 40s. And so there's a kind of a long history of the academic thing.
Well, in addition to your physical genealogy of education and academia, I love that on your website you have your academic genealogy.
Yeah, that is interesting.
It's fascinating that traces your connection with your chair for your dissertation, right, your mentor, and then his, all the way back to the 1700s in Paris. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. That's just fascinating.
Yeah, I think the reason why this works is because there weren't very many who were academics in analytical, actually the field, my field's analytical environmental chemistry, and there weren't that many well-defined fields. There wasn't that much division between scientists and all kinds of fields. A scientist would do chemistry, he would do biology, he would do physics, etc. So those are the lines that we can trace that are actually, as far as I know, absolutely true, to scientists who were major teachers in European institutions in all of science in the way we think about modern science exists in Europe in the 1700s, 1800s, and then their students then start going other places, to other continents. And so there's a single entry from Europe to the United States, and then those professors then had academic children, just like the students who do graduate work under me are, in theory, my academic offspring, and then they go on. So it's like a family tree, and I saw in the Journal of American Chemical Society, I believe, something 15 or so years ago that provided someone else's academic genealogy, And one of the early 20th century scientists I knew to be, I'm going to mix these ideas, the great, great scientific grandfather of my advisor. So I realized that the rest of that scientist, I don't remember who the person was in the Journal of American Chemical Society publication, the rest of that scientist's ancestors, in theory, were mine too. And so I realized I could just make the connection by looking up the names. And all those individual scientists who you see on the webpage are also linked to historical descriptions of their biographies, of their research areas, and for some of the more modern ones, to their individual universities where there are historical documents about them. So it made for a kind of a good kind of historical linkage. And then at the very end, I had the unmitigated audacity to provide a link from me to the page that contains the theses of all my students who, in theory, are my scientific offspring. So it's, I can't say there's no ego involved in all that process. I mean, who wouldn't want to say that somehow they were an offspring of Lavoisier or whatever? So.
Absolutely. It's fascinating, though.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
Now, your dissertation, your PhD, is from the University of Colorado at Boulder. And you finished your dissertation and was awarded your PhD in 1990.
That's true.
And the focus of your dissertation and your research has been chemiluminescence.
It has been to in the
to
early years
degree.
To a certain degree. One of the analytical centers of focus in my laboratory is a specific instrument that was developed by my research advisor at University of Colorado at Boulder. His name is John Burks. And he developed this as a tool to do very, very sensitive analysis for certain families of compounds that are environmentally important, whose concentrations are very low, but that we're still interested in. There are lots of things. As analytical chemistry advances, we become more and more interested in things that human beings come in contact with that are at very, very low concentrations, as opposed to very high concentrations, like how much fat is there in a Wendy's hamburger or something like that. And so that detector is based on chemiluminescence, a chemical reaction in which the products are at a lower energy than the reactants, like reactions that go downhill. But the energy that is left over in that process is released not as heat, but is released as light, and that's the source of the signal, and that's chemiluminescence. And so that detector, which I had my hands on the day before yesterday in my laboratory, is still used routinely in our work and was developed by John Burks, the scientist who was my research advisor at Colorado, the original reason I went to work for him or chose to try to join his analytical group at that level. And at most graduate levels in chemistry, you interview with the advisor and find the work that's going on, and then you ask if there is space in the research group, etc. And so I asked John Burks if I could join his group, and then did, and spent 4.5 years on my PhD. One of his most significant accomplishments, in my eyes anyway, up until then, was that he had studied the effects of large amounts of particles lofted in the environment by nuclear exchanges. This is a theoretical study, that is, since there have only been two nuclear weapons that have been exploded on the planet in a war situation and not for practice, for the lack of any other term, Hiroshima and Nagasaki. These were calculations that said, gee, you know, if the Soviet Union, which existed at the time, he did this calculation in the late 70s, early 80s, if the Soviet Union vaporized most of New York and caught it on fire, and if the United States in anger responded by exploding hydrogen bombs in Moscow, of course the people in those cities would die, but what else would happen? And they did a calculation about the total amount of flammable material in New York and the total amount of flammable material in Moscow, data that's relatively available in common literature. You could ask the number of streets and the density of houses, and, you know, et cetera. And then you got a calculation of the total amount of particles and what temperature they'd be as they lofted in the atmosphere. And the result of the calculation was not only would things be bad for people in large cities and the two countries involved in the nuclear exchange at that point, the calculation involved the Soviet Union and the United States, but those particles would be so warm and would be of the right size, they would be lofted into the stratosphere, and they would circle the Earth, and they would end up blocking sunlight, and that sunlight would cause a change in the climate, a change in the weather for the first 2 or 3 years, and maybe a change in the climate over a longer period of time. But if you had, for instance, in Kansas, no growing season for 2 years, that's a lot of food that is needed to feed people. And so this theory, which was caused by a nuclear exchange that caused a change in climate or a change in weather, was dubbed nuclear winter theory. And that paper is published in a journal called MBio in about 1981, maybe spring of 82. And I had read that paper when I was working on my master's at East Texas State, and then found out where that scientist was, and he was at University of Colorado at Boulder, and I then decided, you know, when I do my PhD, that's where I'd like to go. So I went to actually join his research group to do work in that area. The United States government, however, was not happy with any of the results of that particular, that kind of politically charged research, and he received no funding in that area for the entire time that I was there. So I worked instead in, as we talked about, chemiluminescence. Right. That was the result of that.
That is a great. That's a great story. That's how you got into that research.
Very interesting, man. A good friend of mine to this day.
Absolutely. You also maintain a website on chemiluminescence. Uh-huh. You have for the last over 15 years.
Yeah, for a long time. When we first started to, when it became clear that we were going to have external file space on drives at Sam Houston State, and that the files that were there could be not only accessed inside the school, we started to realize that. As we found files on other computer systems around the world, we started to realize that there was going to be a network availability to people who were outside the school. Then I started to think about what things I did as a scientist that anyone else might be interested in, and one of the first things was, along with Monty Python audio files, one of the first things was the chemiluminescence, and so that was birthed probably about 95, something like that.
You also maintain a web page on atmospheric chemistry glossary.
Yeah, that actually is an ongoing process, and as a matter of fact, every 2 years I teach a class that's in atmospheric chemistry, which of course is the area that John Burke's research involves. So we got there just not while I was working on the PhD. I was more spending time with the chemiluminescence chromatographic instrument, but that every 2 years I teach a course centered around atmospheric chemistry called Air Quality. And the students in that class investigate terms that are used in the field that aren't in the glossary already and that may be useful to them in their classwork, and provide definitions for those words and citations from the literature and things like that. And so we modify the glossary at a minimum every 2 years, and on the off year, the in-between spring, I actually modify it myself and make changes and additions to things that I think are important. And that, the last time I looked, that site receives over 100,000 hits a year people who are looking for things. I mean, as Google exploded and made available, finding information, then it's just, I'm sure they very seldom go to the first page that says, here's where you can find a link to words that begin with A through Z. Instead, they just come in on individual pages and say, gee, you know, I'd really like to know about frontal boundaries and about gas phase concentrations of nitrate particles or whatever, that kind of thing. And so, yeah, that's a good project. And the students, to a degree, enjoy that. And people email me routinely and say we appreciated that. Oh, and here's a bigger compliment. The individual pages are routinely stolen and placed somewhere else with commercials along the edges so that Google searches will end up taking that content and leveraging it and make somebody money. So I know it must be good if it's being stolen.
Well, you've gotten some awards and kind of honors for those web pages and mentions and indexing. And
Yes, that's right. Yeah, that's right. And 10 years ago or so, or maybe a little bit less, maybe 7 or 8 years ago, scientific journals would routinely provide kind of reviews of sites that were useful, and I would see kind of reference to those kinds of things, some of which were critical, like, yeah, I found this page, we can't find out how to work our way around on it, and I loaded the page and thought, yeah, you know, if you just got here by a keyword, how would you find things? So I used that as a critical review and that like a peer review, and thought, yeah, I need to clean up the way the thing is organized and make modifications.
Cool.
So that was useful to me too, so I like that.
You know. You have another web page that I just love. It's called Flash and QuickTime Animations of Analytical Instrumentation.
Yeah. since I'm fooling with this instrument in my research group that uses emission of light as the source of the signal and detection of components, I have found, after failing in the ability to teach ideas initially in some of my most highest level undergraduate classes, in the 400 level as a senior class, I teach an instrumental analysis course. It'll be almost certainly in the last year of an undergraduate degree in chemistry. And the ideas involve, the concepts in the course involve some of the most complex analytical instrumentation that human beings have developed so far that is of any use. For instance, the superconductor supercollider, I think, would be one of the most complicated things or the Hubble Space Telegraph, one of the most complicated things that human beings have developed. So I don't mean that, but what I mean is instrumentation that students who complete an undergraduate degree in chemistry will need to know how to use. And after, as I said before, after failing to actually be able to teach some of the ideas using the common diagrams and common textual descriptions that are in even state-of-the-art texts, I realized that I needed to work and provide additional information, and so that's how the flash animations, originally QuickTime, I originally constructed like you do any animation, just like the first kind of motion picture I saw was a famous set of photographs from the maybe 1870s, 1860s, of someone who wanted to prove that a horse in full gallop had all feet off right. the ground. And so the technique was to provide 20 or 30 cameras with tripwires, and as the horse ran through the tripwires, the cameras were all initiated, and the result was 20 individual frames that were all spaced in time slightly apart. And sure enough, by the way, the horse has all 4 feet off the ground while cantering. But that process for any animation is putting together individual frames in which things change. So originally I constructed, using some software that allowed me to make slight changes pretty quickly, I constructed frame by frame of, for instance, how light moves through a particularly complex schematic, where to start looking at a schematic you've never seen before, how you see how light is dispersed by a monochromator or by a grading system because you're looking at individual colors. And the ideas that were most often the source of the initial animations were ideas that were very, very hard to describe with just either a static image and certainly with just text. And 35 years ago, that same textbook would have been almost 95% text and just a few line drawings, and now high quality and very expensive. Textbooks are 55% text, 45% images, and there's an associated DVD that's shipped with the book and things like that, because we found, I have had a student that finished an undergraduate degree with us, did a master's degree with us, went on to University of Kansas, I believe, and got a PhD, and then went to the East Coast and got a law degree. So this person is not intellectually limited in almost any way I can think of. His test, when I realized there was a very complex data set that I wanted students to understand how it was generated, and I talked about it with the static images, when he didn't do well on that test, I realized, you can either conclude, gosh, these students are not very smart, and I must get better students. However, it was obvious how bright this person was, and a number of students. I realized I wasn't doing a very good job. And so most of the things that I do on my website for teaching documents are efforts to address ways to move information from outside of the world into the students' heads. And the result is that people view and come and link and ask questions about those animations from all over the world now. Not a large amount, but enough to show, and make comments like, I don't understand this, showing that I need to modify, again, a natural kind of peer review process. Yes. Something needs to be fixed, because they didn't, if that's the person who wrote in and said he didn't understand that, then how many people saw it, didn't understand it, and didn't say anything at all. So that site's, again, a teaching tool. Kind of.
That's amazing that you embrace every technology that comes along to enhance your teaching.
It's fun. Well, I'm a Macintosh person, so it comes naturally.
Oh, okay. No PC for you.
Right, no PC. I don't have time. It's too slow for me to stay. So.
Hey, let's talk just a little bit, because this is fascinating to me, about your collaboration with the University of Santiago, Chile, and Andrés Bello University in Chile, and the research that you're doing there in collaboration with some analytical chemists there.
Analytical. I'm the analytical chemist. This is a true collaboration in that the group meeting that involves all these scientists together, number one, they're thinking in Spanish and I'm thinking in English, or maybe barely thinking in English. And number two, it's truly collaborative because I'm the analytical chemist, and one of them is a biochemist, and another one is a microbiologist, and another one is a toxicologist, which makes for extremely fertile collaborative processes because everybody's thinking about the problem from a different point of view and knows things about it in a different point of view. I've probably been collaborating with Dr. Claudio Vasquez at University of Santiago since I think our first paper was 2004, and so we've probably been working together. He sent his first student to me to work in my lab, a postdoc to work in my lab, 2003 or something like that. And it is a very fertile project in that we routinely have something in the hopper from work that, for instance, I went there for the fourth time in the summer last summer. Another of his students will come to my lab in May of this year. So there's a student exchange idea, there's a person exchange idea, and he actually has come and visited my lab too, et cetera. The funding for that process has come from grants that we write together that he, of course, translates into Spanish and then submits to the Chilean government, who is very, very supportive of scientists who are working in Chile. The population of people is relatively small in the country, and the population of scientists is relatively small, and the government funds a large amount of that, and they've been very good for funding my trips and things that we do in his lab there. It's absolutely fascinating. And to go, you know, to be in a research group in which they're always very kind to me when we are having a research group meeting, and just I am there, everybody else in the room is thinking in Spanish, and they're always kind enough. The entire research group meeting is held in English, so they get to practice their English, of course. But it slows them down. It's a task on them, but they're always interested in communicating and will explain anything that I ask about, and then they ask questions about the analytical work we do. So the collaborative process of people I just described, but we also, they move genetic information that involves specific tasks. They find an organism. We find an organism that has a very high resistance to one of the toxic elements that I'm interested in, selenium or tellurium. And they find a set of genetic instructions in one organism that does something we're interested in. They take it out of that organism and put it into another organism and then clone that organism and produce a culture where we've made a modification. And then we're interested to see what that modification does. We grow the organism in Texas and amend it with various chemicals, and then, surprise, look at chemicals given off with the chemiluminescence detector and things like that. And so it involves analytical chemistry on our part, some microbiological work on our part, microbiology, genetic manipulation, biochemistry on their part. So we're working from three or four different angles at once.
It's fascinating.
Yeah, it's very, very interesting.
When you went down to Chile the last time, this past summer?
Yes.
How long were you there?
That was a very long trip. The funding for that particular grant had a minimum of 30 days, and that was difficult to fit in the schedule of everything we had to do. But we flew in and then spent time in the laboratory and collaborated, went and did talks at various other universities and worked with students there. And I went to the coast of Chile and got to see the site where the large wave that had come in from the earthquake, from an earthquake that had been off the coast came. A tsunami, basically a southern hemispheric tsunami, and that was 30 days. So it was a 30-day long trip.
Wow!
And that was very productive. That's one paper has been published from that work, and another one's in draft, and another one's in kind of the minds of two or three people. You know, so and that's very good. And of course, when we're all writing together, right? All our papers are published in English, but of course they're thinking all of the science in Spanish, right? And it's really there's something to be said, and I've always thought this to be true and not been able to ever bring it to fruit, but the aspect of translating complex ideas from one language to another gives you a really, I think it involves brain activity that helps, I think maybe, it involves brain activity that helps make your science better because of the way you have to think about it.
You have to think about it.
Different parts of your brain, whereas I just, I'm much simpler or simplistic in my science. I don't know why they want me, but, we do very well together.
Understand why they want you, because you are a dynamic personality and you're devoted to your discipline.
Yeah, that's certainly true.
It's very obvious. It's very obvious.
Thank you.
Thank you for sharing your time with me today, and I really applaud all of your academic accomplishments, and you are an asset to Sam Houston State University, and we really appreciate you.
That's very kind of you to say. Thank you very much.
It is,
thanks for your time.
It's my pleasure.
Good.
Thank you, Tom.